I start with that, but there aren't a lot of places that I feel like I can, as my longtime recovery sponsor said, sit all the way down in the chair. Y'all make that possible for me here. Don't know how you do it, but you do. And a particular shout out here to Margaret. One of my wise teachers said, when we get real, it's getting real. So thank you for sharing your heartache with us. Yeah. On a completely different note, I've been thinking about roller coasters. You've been one of those. It's that world. Well, here's the funny thing about roller coasters. You know, you can be terrorized or exhilarated on a roller coaster, and it has nothing to do with a roller coaster. It has everything to do with what we bring to the roller coaster. Everything to do with what we bring to the roller coaster. So the proposition is, how do you bring good, God, the allness, the wholeness, into the terror on a roller coaster? Especially if the roller coaster is the present contemporary environment. If y'all didn't know, we're on a roller coaster ride together. And it's messy and challenging and ugly and all those sorts of things. And you can't just blind yourself to it. And just like the roller coaster, you can't just say, let's go change it. As they say, it is what it is. So the question becomes, how do we change our relationship to the roller coaster? Which sounds like a unity space to me. That's about our insides, not our outsides. Because when the insides are right, the outsides take care of themselves. I've been studying lately Mingyur Rinpoche, a Tibetan teacher. And he taught something really profound, which really struck me. It's very consistent with what comes out of the Hindu religion, Shiva the Destroyer. It turns out the Tibetan Buddhists believe that the cycle begins with the death of the autumn, not with the emergence in the spring. That it takes a death, it takes destruction, it takes something falling apart to set the scene for something new to emerge. And yet we like to look at the pretty flowers popping up, right? Well, fall's really beautiful for a little while, but you know, the decay, the death, all those things. And so the proposition for us is, how do you bring God, good, allness, and wholeness into death and destruction? I have a friend in recovery who says, darn it, Ron, we can't just look at the pretty stuff and call that grace. Either grace includes it all, or there can't be grace. So how do we bring that into those difficult, challenging, troubling spaces? One of my favorite musicians, Arlo Guthrie. Yeah, Arlo. Arlo said it this way. You can't have a light without a dark to stick it in. Sounds like Hindu wisdom to me. So let's play with that for a moment. I would like each of you to look around at least 4 or 5 people around you, and I want you to make eye contact with them. Don't just do the cursory scan on by. Look in their eyes, 4 or 5 people. I will be quiet while you do that. Brilliant. And probably a lot more fun than listening to me, because you got to see each other. So because I do a lot of work in public health, I know what the data says. The data says that 2 of the people you just looked in the eyes of have unresolved trauma, mental health issues, unaddressed grief, sorrow, breakdown in their family systems or communities. And you may be one of them. And we don't talk about it, do we? We don't acknowledge your grief. We laugh with you, we'll let you cry, and then we're going to go to the buffet. it makes us uncomfortable to go into the dark spaces. But if it's true that the dark spaces are a requirement for the light spaces, then avoiding the dark precludes the light. We can't work in dark places from the light. If anything, the recovering world has taught us this. The recovering world works, for those of you who are in the recovering world, and I know you're out there because the data says there's a bunch of you. We know that the way you work in darkness is to enter the darkness and place your hand in the hand of the person in the darkness. You don't coach them out. You don't lift them up. You join them there. And grace comes there. Jungian psychology supports this. All the work in HIV, AIDS, death and dying, all of it agrees with this. But it's so hard for us because we want to show up with a smile on our face and a lightness in our step, and we want to pretend like we're not grieving, not suffering, not challenged, and we can't find the light without going into the darkness. It's the craziest thing in the world. In fact, one of my mentors in recovery said, when I get out of here, I want someone to answer why they designed it this way. This makes no sense. And yet this is what we have to work with. So a concept I've been working a lot with that is central to the dark side of grace is called post-traumatic growth. There's a thing. It's the opposite of post-traumatic stress. It's remarkable. Here's what the research is showing. The same stuff that destroys people and their lives is the same stuff that may very well transform them and their lives. It's in the darkness that the magic comes, and yet we want to avoid it. Let me repeat that. It's so profound. The same stuff, it's like a split in the woods. The same stuff that breaks people down can break them open and create transformation. The question is, and there's a little bit of Greek in this, the Greeks told us that it is not what fate brings that dictates our destiny, it is what we do with what fate brings. Because we can't protect you from difficulties, we just can't. Someone's going to die, something awful's going to happen in your neighborhood, someone's going to break out the firearms, someone's going to drop dead from opioid abuse. This is the space I'm in all the time, and we can't pretend like it's not there. But the proposition is what we can do is we can join people there. We can go into the darkness, which is how the light finds the darkness. Avoiding it doesn't work. Let me give you some examples. Anybody who's in recovery, I won't ask for a show of hands because we believe in anonymity, except for mine, obviously. I gotta tell you, one of the things that causes addiction or promotes addiction is there's so much shame and guilt around it that we're afraid to talk openly, and I talk openly. I'm 37 years sober, and it almost caused me to take my own life. It was razor thin back in 1985 whether I would live or die. The guy I am today who's standing up here doing these things, writing these books, showing up in these places, is the guy who almost got destroyed. And the same stuff that destroyed me as a result, could have destroyed me as a result of all the things that came to me in that dark, difficult, ugly place are what transformed me. There's a song I've been listening to, there's a great line, I am a resurrected man. That's my story. And I'm not resurrected out of virtue, I'm resurrected out of having been broken down at the most fundamental level. And then something found me through the hands of God knows how many people. One of my favorite examples is Maya Angelou. God, I love what that woman became. But her starting point was rape. She went mute for 5 years. She had awful circumstances, and what came out of that soup of distress was a remarkable human being with an amazing capacity to talk to us in ways that seems to transcend race, nationality, ethnicity, I mean, you name it. And it came out of being violated. Not out of virtue. There's a new emergent historical theory that Abraham Lincoln was so good because he spent his life in pain. They're now hypothesizing his rickety frame and everything was a particular medical condition, and that through all those failures and all those challenges, he was probably in an unusually high degree of pain almost all the time. And they hypothesize he could have never borne up in the face of so difficult a time had he not been normalized with deep pain. Out of awful lifelong pain, if the hypothesis is true, comes a guy who's able to hold a space for us that turns out to be transformative. I mean, you all know this. It's the hero's journey, right? Nobody ever gets up here and says, well, let me tell you how I've had no challenges. Right? It's all been a cavort through the tulip patch, and I'd like you to join me. We'll go like, nah, I got nothing to talk to this guy about. I want to know how they got out of the dirty stuff. So I want to tell you a story. You all know story is so very powerful and important. And then we'll do a meditation. This is a woman I'm going to name Sharon because she would prefer to be anonymous. Sharon's story is that when she was in her mother's womb, her mother used to pound on her stomach saying, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Her mother was an addict with a long history of all kinds of problems. So we would say today that Sharon was traumatized in utero, which is an awful thing. I wouldn't wish that on any child. And yet, that's her story. Probably, we think, because that's the kind of stuff that happened to her mama. Generational trauma passed down, we know that's a thing. For all kinds of reasons. Vietnam vets. We have lots of documentation on that. So anyway, Sharon's life went off the rails badly. Addiction, you name it. She has it in her portfolio. Awful, terrible, terrible story. And it did almost kill her. Few people saved her. She did all that work around all the trauma, which included a lot of sexual abuse when she was little. And she and I were talking one day, and we discovered the transformation point. What she finally saw was that she had been so neglected that those men who perpetrated her gave her attention which she wanted badly. And she had blocked it off because to admit that she needed desperately that attention sounds like the worst thing in the world to admit. But as soon as that came out of her, Katie barred the door, as they say. Something shifted. Some kind of light found its way in there. The shame dissipated. Today, Sharon is in the darkness with I do not know how many young women who have been violated. And she's not doing it out of virtue. She is what the archetype calls the wounded healer. And the archetype says you can't do that healing work without first healing your own wounds, which means you got to do your own dark work. You got to go to the dark side. We were laughing out there about it. Sounds very Star Wars. Many of us are going to have to go to the dark side to get the light in there in order to bring it forth into the world. Which is like the last Sunday message, right? I'm supposed to like uplift you. Except that's how you change the world. One awful, messy, challenging situation at a time. Terry Tempest Williams said this. I've used her quote before. She's the great Utah Mormon author. She said, finding beauty in a broken world is creating beauty in the world we find. We're the creators of the beauty, my friends. And we do that by going into the broken and hanging out there with people and ourselves so we can heal. And then the healing bears fruit. Last comment. In the past, since I have been here last, I talked a lot about namaste, moving to elevation, vertical, going vertical. What I have seen is that space for healing and for the fruit that is to be born only grows and increases if we are willing to go inside and do that difficult work and then do that difficult work with others. And most of you are going, I'm not doing that. And I understand. But most of us have a moment that comes to us. The most amazing thing today is watching what Sharon does in the world. I have watched her. And all you can do is sit back and say, well, glory be. There is a thing called post-traumatic growth. It comes out of the same soup that is so difficult and damaging. And our task is to work there. If we want to use the master, Jesus was not hanging out with all the enlightened, friendly people. That's where the work gets to be done, because that's where we need to do the work. So as I like to say, if you're going to change the world, it starts there. Probably with some things you would just as soon not deal with, because you're human. So I'd like you to close your eyes. My good friend Jim Peterson, who is now gone from the earth, who was sober for 57 years, used to say over and over again, in this gravelly voice, he looked just like Colonel Harlan Sanders. And he would say, cuddle up to your pains and your fears, your heartache. Cuddle up to it. Make friends with it. Let it teach you. So what I'd invite you to do is to call to mind some tender spot in your insides. Some tender, fragile, wounded, unhealed, problematic space. And just imagine it for a moment. You don't have to collapse into it. Just imagine for a moment how that feels inside of you. Just notice how it feels. Nothing need doing. And then with a nice, long, slow breath, cuddle up to that tender spot. Bring your awareness, use your breath, cuddle up to that tender spot. Nothing need be done. Nothing but your awareness, your presence. And just breathe in that space for a moment. And then with your next breath, see if you can let a little light into that tender spot. Just a little bit of light. You don't have to do anything. Just let a little bit of light in. And then with your next breath, imagine more light. See if you can imagine with that breath gaining some elevation, some uplift, some grace. And with one more breath, even more light. Even more uplift. And then in that secret place deep down inside you, say to yourself, to your God, to the good, thank you, even for this tender spot. One last breath. Expand your chest. Wiggle your toes. Remember you're on planet Earth. I would wish for all of you to become wounded healers. That's the path for many of us. And I'm so thankful to be here to hang out with you.
flow, Spirit, flow through me as I open up to be an expression of your unfolding peace. Show, Spirit, show through me as I open up to be an expression of your unfolding.